Hello, angels. It is me, Willow, which comes as no surprise to you because that's the audio you clicked on. I am here with the ninth and final chapter of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. I'm kind of sad, honestly. I really like this book and I really like this series that I've got going on. I enjoy reading to you guys and I enjoy getting to talk to you guys about the book itself, and I know some of you are interested in listening even though you haven't started yet, so if you're just getting to this now, that's fantastic and I'm glad you're here. This is the last installment though, so if you haven't heard chapters 1 through 8, I suggest you go back and listen to them first. They are pinned in the media channel of my Discord and they are also at the very bottom of my audio index on Reddit. This is a completely safe for work audio, and if you are looking for not safe for work content, I suggest you scroll on up in that aforementioned audio index and pick something that's closer to the top. There's a bunch of stuff there. There is a bunch of improvs, a bunch of ramble faps, some jack-off instructions. I am a bisexual switch, so different strokes for different folks. I hope you find something that you like, because there's a wide array of things to find. Okay. This book is set in the 1920s, and as such, there is a lot of racism, there's a lot of sexism, and as of late, in the past couple chapters, there's been a lot of violence. Those are trigger warnings. They're topics that are uncomfortable and painful, and I would not blame you if you don't want to listen to them. So if that's not up your alley, you are more than welcome to slide by and not listen. I will not be offended in even the least. This is my favorite book, and it's been kind of an honor getting to share it with you guys, and I'm really glad that you let me do this. Like, I'm gonna take just a minute to get on my little pedestal and say thank you, because I know why you're here. I know what brought you here first, and then you gave me a platform to have people around me that are kind and good and nice to each other, and kind to me and treat me like a person, which I didn't think I would find. So thank you, and especially thank you for this little project, because it's been fun. Anyway, this is the last chapter, so get yourself really cozy, get yourself something to drink. I have cranberry juice because that's where I'm at tonight, and I don't think I've missed anything, so without further ado, buckle yourself in for the last ride. We have F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, Chapter 9. After 2 years, I remember the rest of that day, and that night, and the next day, only as an endless drill of police and photographers and newspaper men in and out of Gatsby's front door. A rope stretched across the main gate, and a policeman by it kept out the curious, but little boys soon discovered that they could enter through my yard. And there was always a few of them clustered open-mouthed about the pool. Someone with a positive manner, perhaps a detective, used the expression madman as he bent over Wilson's body that afternoon. The advantageous authority of his voice set the key for the newspaper reports the next morning. Most of those reports were a nightmare, grotesque, circumstantial, eager, and untrue. When Michaelis's testimony at the inquest brought to light Wilson's suspicion of his wife, I thought the whole tale would shortly be served up in a racy pasquinade. But Catherine, who might have said anything, didn't say a word. She showed a surprising amount of character about it, too. Looked at the coroner with determined eyes under the correct brow of hers, and swore that her sister had never seen Gatsby. And that her sister was completely happy with her husband, and that her sister had been into no mischief whatsoever. She convinced herself of it and cried into her handkerchief as if the very suggestion was more than she could endure. So Wilson was reduced to a man, deranged by grief, and ordered that the case might remain in its simplest form, and it rested there. But all this part of it seemed remote and unessential. I found myself on Gatsby's side and alone. From the moment I telephoned news of the catastrophe to the West Egg Village, every surmise about him and every practical question was referred to me. At first I was surprised and confused. Then, as he lay in his house and didn't move or breathe or speak, hour upon hour, it grew on me that I was responsible, because no one else was interested. Interested, I mean, with that intense personal interest to which everyone with some vague right had at the end. I called up Daisy half an hour after we found him, called her instinctively and without hesitation, but she and Tom had gone away early that afternoon and taken baggage with them. Left no address? No. Say when they'd be back? No. Any idea where they are? How I could reach them? I don't know. Can't say. I wanted to get somebody for him. I wanted to go into the room where he lay and reassure him. I'll get someone for you, Gatsby. Don't worry. Just trust me and I'll get somebody for you. Mayor Wolfsheim's name wasn't in the phone book. The butler gave me his office address on Broadway, and I called him for information, but by the time I had the number, it was long after 5, and no one answered the phone. Will you ring again? I've rung him 3 times. It's very important. Sorry, I'm afraid no one's there. I went back into the drawing room and thought for an instant that there were chance visitors. All these official people suddenly filled it. But as they drew back the sheet and looked at Gatsby's with unmoving eyes, his protest continued in my brain. Look here, O'Sport, you've got to get somebody for me. You've got to try hard. I can't go through this alone. Someone started to ask me questions, but I broke away and, going upstairs, looked hastily through the unlocked parts of his desk. He never told me definitely that his parents were dead, but there was nothing, only the picture of Dan Cody, a token of forgotten violence, staring down from the wall. Next morning, I sent the butler to New York with a letter for Wolfsheim, which asked for information and urged him to come out on the next train. That request seemed superfluous when I wrote it. I was sure he'd start when he saw the newspapers, just as I was sure there'd be a wire from Daisy before noon. But neither a wire nor Mr. Wolfsheim arrived. No one arrived except more police and photographers and newspapermen. When the butler brought back Wolfsheim's answer, I began to have a feeling of defiance, of scornful solidarity between Gatsby and me against them all. Sorry. Dear Mr. Carraway, this has been one of the most terrible shocks of my life. To me, I hardly can believe that it is true at all. Such mad acts that a man did should make us all think. I cannot come down now, as I'm tied up in some very important business and cannot get mixed up in this thing right now. If there's anything I can do a little later, let me know by letter to Edgar. I hardly know where I am when I hear about a thing like this and completely knocked down and out. Yours truly, Mayor Wolfsheim. And then hastily, addenda beneath. Let me know about his funeral, etc. I do not know his family at all. When the phone rang that afternoon and long distance said Chicago was calling, I thought this would be Daisy at last. But the connection came through in a man's voice, very thin and far away. This is Sagal speaking. Yes? The name was unfamiliar. Hell of a note, isn't it? Get my wire? There haven't been any wires. Young Park's in trouble, he said rapidly. They picked him up and he handed the bonds over the counter. They got a circular from New York giving him the numbers just 5 minutes before. What do you know about that, hey? You never can tell in these hick towns. Hello? I interrupted breathlessly. Look here, this isn't Mr. Gatsby. Mr. Gatsby's dead. There was a long silence on the other end of the wire, followed by an exclamation, then a quick squawk as the connection was broken. I think it was on the third day that a telegram signed Henry C. Gatz arrived from a town in Minnesota. It said only that the sender was leaving immediately and to postpone the funeral until he came. It was Gatsby's father, a solemn old man, very helpless and dismayed, bundled up in a long, cheap ulster against the warm September day. His eyes leaked continuously with excitement, and when I took the bag and umbrella from his hands, he began to pull so incessantly at his sparse gray beard that I had difficulty getting off his coat. He was on the point of collapse, so I took him to the music room and made him sit down while I sent for something to eat. But he wouldn't eat, and the glass of milk spilled from his trembling hand. I saw it in the Chicago newspaper, he said. It was all in the Chicago newspaper. I started right away. I didn't know how to reach you. His eyes, seeing nothing, moved carelessly about the room. It was a madman, he said. He must have been mad. Wouldn't you like some coffee? I urged him. I don't want anything. I'm all right now, Mr. Carraway. Well, I'm all right now. Where have they got Jimmy? I took him into the drawing room where his son lay and left him there. Some little boys had come up on the steps and were looking into the hall. When I told them who had arrived, they went away reluctantly. After a little while, Mr. Gatz opened the door and came out, his mouth ajar, his face flushed slightly, his eyes leaking isolated and unpunctual tears. He had reached an age where death no longer has the quality of ghostly surprise, and when he looked around him now for the first time and saw the height and splendor of the hall and the great rooms opening out from it into other rooms, his grief began to be mixed with an odd pride. I helped him to the bedroom upstairs. While he took off his coat and vest, I told him that all the arrangements had been deferred until he came. "I didn't know what you'd want, Mr. Gatsby." "Gatz is my name." "Mr. Gatz, I thought you might want to take the body west." He shook his head. "Jimmy always liked it better down east. He rose up to his position in the east. You were a friend of my boy's, Mr. We were close friends. He had a big future before him, you know. He was only a young man, and he had a lot of brain power here." He touched his head impressively, and I nodded. If he'd have lived, he'd have been a great man. A man like James J. Hill, he'd have helped build up the country." "That's true," I said uncomfortably. He fumbled at the embroidered coverlet, trying to take it from the bed, and lay down stiffly, and was instantly asleep. That night, an obviously frightened person called up and demanded to know who I was before I would give him his name. "This is Mr. Carraway," I said. "Oh," he sounded relieved. "This is Clipspringer." I was relieved, too, for that seemed to promise another friend at Gatsby's grave. I didn't want it to be in the papers and draw a sightseeing crowd, so I'd been calling up a few people myself. They were hard to find. "The funeral's tomorrow," I said. 3:00, here at the house. I wish you'd tell anybody who'd be interested." "Oh, I will," he broke out hastily. "Of course, I'm not likely to see anybody, but if I do..." His tone made me suspicious. "Of course you'll be there yourself." "Well, I'll certainly try. What I called up about is..." "Wait a minute," I interrupted. "How about saying you'll come?" "Well, the truth of the matter is, I'm staying with the people up here in Greenwich, and they'd rather expect me to be with them tomorrow. In fact, there's sort of a picnic or something. Of course, I'll do my very best to get away." I ejaculated an unrestrained, "Huh?" And he must have heard me, for then he went on nervously. What I called up about was about a pair of shoes I left there. I wonder if it'd be too much trouble to have the butler send them on. You see, they're tennis shoes, and I'm sort of helpless without them. My address is care of BF... I didn't hear the rest of his name because I hung up on the receiver. After that, I felt certain shame for Gatsby. One gentleman, to whom I telephoned, implied that he had got what he deserved. However, that was my fault for he was one of those that used to sneer most bitterly at Gatsby on the courage of Gatsby's liquor, and I should have known better than to call him. The morning of the funeral, I went up to New York to see Mayor Wolfsheim. I couldn't seem to reach him any other way. The door that I pushed open, on the advice of elevator boy, was marked the Swastika Holding Company, and at first there didn't seem to be anyone inside, but when I shouted hello several times in vain, an argument broke out behind a partition, and presented a lovely Jewess appeared in an interior door and scrutinized me with black, hostile eyes. "Nobody's in," she said. "Mr. Wolfsheim's gone to Chicago." The first part of this was obviously untrue, for someone had begun to whistle the rosary tunelessly inside. "Please say that Mr. Carraway wants to see him." "I can't get him back from Chicago, can I?" And at this moment, a voice, unmistakably Wolfsheim's, called, "Stella!" from the other side of the door. "Leave your name on the desk," she said quickly. "I'll give it to him when he gets back." "But I know he's here." She took a step towards me and began to slide her hands indignantly up and down her hips. You young man think you can force your way in here any time," she scolded. "I'm getting sick and tired of it. When I say he's in Chicago, he's in Chicago." I mentioned Gatsby. "Oh," she looked me over again. "What's your name?" She vanished. In a moment, Mayor Wolfsheim stood solemnly in the doorway, holding out both of his hands. He drew me into his office, remarking in a reverent voice that it was a sad time for us all, and then he offered me a cigar. My memory goes way back to when I first met him, he said. A young major just out of the army and covered with medals that he'd gotten in the war. He was so hard up, he had to keep on wearing his uniform because he couldn't buy some regular clothes. First time I saw him was when he came into Weinbrenner's pool room at 43rd Street and asked for a job. He hadn't eaten anything for a couple days. Come on and have lunch with me, I said. He ate more than $4 worth of food in half an hour. Did you start him in business? I inquired. Start him? I made him. Oh. I raised him up out of nothing, right out of the gutter. I saw right away that he was a fine-appearing, gentlemanly young man. And when he told me he was in Oxford, I knew I could use him good. I got him to join up in the American Legion, and he used to stand right here. Right off, he did some work for a client of mine up in Albany. We were so thick like that and everything. He held up two bulbous fingers. Always together. I wondered if this partnership had included the World Series transaction in 1919. Now he's dead, I said after a moment. You were his closest friend, and I know you'll want to come to his funeral. This afternoon. I'd like to come. Well, come then. The hair in his nostrils quivered slightly, and he shook his head as his eyes filled with tears. I can't do it. I can't get mixed up in it, he said. There's nothing to get mixed up in. It's all over now. When a man gets killed, I never like to get mixed up in it anyway. I keep out. When I was a young man, it was different. If a friend of mine died, no matter how, I stuck with them until the end. You might think this sentimental, but I mean it. To the bitter end. I saw that for some reason of his own, he was determined not to come, so I stood up. Are you a college man? He inquired suddenly. For a moment, I thought he was going to suggest a negotiation, but he only nodded and shook my hand. Let us learn how to show our friendship for a man when he is alive and not after he's dead, he suggested. After that, my own rule is to let everything alone. When I left his office and the sky had turned dark, I got back to West Egg in a drizzle. After changing my clothes, I went next door and found Mr. Gatz walking up and down excitedly in a hall. His pride in his son and his son's possessions was continually increasing, and now he had something to show me. Jimmy sent me this picture. He took out his wallet with trembling fingers. Look here. It was a photograph of the house, cracked in some corners and dirty with many hands. He pointed out every detail to me eagerly. Look here. And then sought some admiration for my eyes. He had shown it so often that I think it was more real to him now than the house itself. Jimmy sent it to me. I think it's a very pretty picture. It shows up well. Very well. Had you seen him lately? He came out to see me 2 years ago and bought me the house I live in now. Of course, we was broke up when he ran off from home, but now I see there was a reason for it. He knew he had a big future in front of him, and ever since he made a success, he was very generous with me. He seemed reluctant to put away the picture, held it for another minute, lingeringly, before my eyes. Then he returned it to the wallet and pulled out from his pocket a ragged old copy of a book called Hopalong Cassidy. Look here. This is a book he had when he was a boy. It just shows you. He opened it to the back cover and turned it for me to see. On the last flyleaf was printed the word schedule and the date September 12th, 1906. And underneath, rise from bed, 6 a.m. Dumbbell exercise and wall scaling, 6:15 to 6:30. Study electricity, etc., 7:15 to 8:15. Work, 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. Baseball and sports, 4:30 to 5. Practice elocution, poise, and how to attain it, 5 to 6. Study needed inventions, 7 to 9. General resolves, not wasting time at shafters, or a name indecipherable. No more smoking or chewing. Bathe every other day. Read one improving book or magazine a week. Save $5, crossed out, $3 per week. Be better to parents. I come across this book by accident, said the old man. It just shows you, don't it? Just shows you. Jimmy was bound to get ahead. He always had some resolves like this or something. Do you notice what he's got about approving his mind? He's always great for that. He told me I had a I ate like a hog once and I beat him for it. He was reluctant to close the book, reading each item aloud and then looking eagerly at me. I think he rather expected me to copy down a list for my own use. A little before 3, the Lutheran minister arrived from Flushing, and I began to look involuntarily out the windows for other cars. So did Gatsby's father. And as time passed, the servants came in and stood waiting in the hall. His eyes began to blink anxiously, and he spoke of the rain in a worried, uncertain way. The minister glanced several times at his watch, so I took him aside and asked him to wait for half an hour. But it wasn't any use. Nobody came. About 5 o'clock, our procession of three cars reached the cemetery and stopped in a thick drizzle beside the gate. First a motor hearse, horribly black and wet. Then Mr. Gatson, the minister, and I in the limousine. And a little later, 4 or 5 servants and the postman from West Egg and Gatsby station wagon, all wet to the skin. As we started through the gate into the cemetery, I heard a car stop and the sound of someone splashing after us over the soggy ground. I looked around. It was the man with owl-eyed glasses whom I'd found marveling over Gatsby's books in the library one night 3 months before. I'd never seen him since then. I don't know how he knew about the funeral, or even his name. The rain poured down on his thick glasses, and he took them off and wiped them to see the protecting canvas unrolled from Gatsby's grave. I tried to think about Gatsby then for a moment, but he was already too far away, and I could only remember, without resentment, that Daisy hadn't sent message or a flower. Dimly, I heard some murmur, "Blessed are the dead that the rain falls on," and then the owl man said, "Amen to that," in a brave voice. We straggled down quickly, through the rain, to the cars. Owl Eyes spoke to me by the gate. "I couldn't get in the house," he remarked. "Neither can anybody else." "Go on," he started. "Why, my God, they used to be in there by the hundreds." He took off his glasses and wiped them again, outside and in. "The poor son of a bitch," he said. One of my most vivid memories is coming back west from prep school and later from college at Christmas time. Those who went further than Chicago would gather in the old, dim Union Station at 6 o'clock of a December evening with a few Chicago friends already caught up in their own holiday gaieties to bid them a hasty goodbye. I remember the fur coats of the girls returning from Miss This or That's and the chatter of frozen breath and the hands waving overhead as we caught sight of old acquaintances and the matching of invitations. "Are you going to the Ordways? The Hersey's? The Schultz's?" And the long green tickets clasped tight in our gloved hands. And the last of the murky yellow cars from Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad looking cheerfully as Christmas itself on the tracks beside the gate. When we pulled out into the winter night and let the real snow, our snow, begin to stretch beside us and twinkle against the windows, and the dim light of small Wisconsin stations moved by, a sharp, wild brace came suddenly into the air. We drew in deep breaths of it as we walked back from the dinner through the cold vestibules, utterly unaware or of identity within this country for the strange hour before we melted indistinguishably into it again. That's my Middle West. Not the wheat or the prairies or the lost Swede towns, but the thrilling returning of trains of my youth and street lamps and sleigh bells and the frosty dark and the shadows of holly wreaths thrown by lighted windows on the snow. I'm part of that, a little solemn with the feel of those long winters, a little complacent from growing up in the caraway house in a city where dwellings were still called through decades by a family's name. I see now that this has been a story of the West after all. Tom and Gatsby, Daisy and Jordan, and I were all Westerners, and perhaps possessed some deficiency in common which made us subtly unadaptable to Eastern life. Even when the East excited me most, when I was most keenly aware of its superiority to the bored, sprawling, swollen towns beyond the Ohio, with their indeterminable inquisitions spread, spared only the children and the very old, even then it had always, for me, a quality of distortion. West Egg especially, still figures in my more fantastic dreams. I see it as a night scene by El Greco, 100 houses, at once conventional and grotesque, crouching under a sullen overhang overhanging sky and a lustrous moon. In the foreground, four solemn men in dress suits are walking along the sidewalk with a stretcher on which lies a drunken woman in a white evening dress. Her hand, which dangles over the side, sparkles with cold jewels. Gravely, the men turn in at the house, the wrong house, but no one knows the woman's name and no one cares. After Gatsby's death, the East was haunted for me like that, distorted beyond my eyes, power of correction. So when the blue smoke of brittle leaves was in the air and the wind blew my wet laundry stiff on the line, I decided to come back home. There was one thing to be done before I left, an awkward, unpleasant thing that perhaps had been better let alone. But I wanted to leave things in order and not just trust the obliging and indifferent sea to sweep my refuse away. I saw Jordan Baker and talked over what had happened to us together and what had happened afterward to me, and she lay perfectly still, listening in a big chair. She was dressed to play golf, and I remember thinking she looked like a good illustration, her chin raised a little jauntily, her hair the color of an autumn leaf, her face the same brown tint as the fingerless glove on her knee. And when I had finished, she told me without comment that she was engaged to another man. I doubted that, though there were several she could have married at a nod of her head, but I pretended to be surprised. For just a minute, I wondered if I wasn't making a mistake. Then I thought it all over again quickly and got up to say goodbye. "Nevertheless, you did throw me over," said Jordan suddenly. "You threw me over the telephone. I didn't give a damn about you now. But it was a new experience for me, and I still felt a little dizzy after a while. We shook hands." "Oh, and do you remember," she added, "a conversation we had once about driving a car?"
"Why, not exactly."
"You said you're a bad driver. You said a bad driver was only safe until she met another bad driver." "Well, I met another bad driver, didn't I? I mean, it was careless of me to make such a wrong guess. I thought you were a rather honest and straightforward person. I thought it was your secret pride."
"I'm 30, I said. "I'm 5 years too old to lie to myself and call it honor."
She didn't answer. Angry and half in love with her and tremendously sorry, I turned away. One afternoon, late in October, I saw Tom Buchanan. He was walking ahead of me on Fifth Avenue in his alert, aggressive way, his hands out a little bit from his body as if to fight off interference, his head moving sharply here and there, adapting itself to restless eyes. Just as I slowed up to avoid overtaking him, he stopped and began frowning into the windows of a jewelry store. Suddenly he saw me and walked back, holding out his hand. "What's the matter, Nick? Do you object to shaking hands with me?" "Yes, you know what I think of you."
"You're crazy, Nick," he said quickly. "Crazy as hell. I don't know what's the matter with you."
"Tom," I inquired, "what did you say to Wilson that afternoon?" He stared at me without a word, and I knew I had guessed right about those missing hours. I started to turn away, but he took a step towards me and grabbed my arm. "I told him the truth," he said. "He came to the door while we were getting ready to leave, and when I sent down word that we weren't in, he tried to force his way upstairs. He was crazy enough to kill me if I hadn't told him who owned the car. His hand was on the revolver in his pocket every minute he was at the house." He broke off defiantly. "What if I did tell him? That fellow had it coming to him. He threw dust into your eyes just like he did Daisy's, but he's a tough one. He ran over Myrtle like you'd run over a dog, and you never even stopped his car." There was nothing I could say except one utterable fact that it wasn't true. "And if you think I didn't have my share of suffering. Look here, when I went to give up that flat and I saw the damn box of dog biscuits sitting there on the sideboard, I sat down and cried like a baby. By God, it was awful. I couldn't forgive him or like him, but I saw what he had done to him. But I saw what he had done was, to him, entirely justified. It was all very careless and confused. They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money for their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess that they had made." I shook hands with him. It seemed silly not to, for I felt suddenly as though I were talking to a child. Then he went into the jewelry store to buy a He went into the jewelry store to buy a pearl necklace, or perhaps it was a pair of cuff buttons, rid of my provincial squeamishness forever.
Gatsby's house was still empty when I left. The grass on his lawn had grown as long as mine. One of the taxi drivers in the village never took a fare past the entrance of the gate without stopping for a minute and pointing it inside. Perhaps it was he who drove Daisy and Gatsby over to the East Egg the night of the accident, and perhaps he had made a story about it all on his own. I didn't want to hear it, and I avoided him when I got off the train. I spent my Saturday nights in New York because those gleaming, dazzling parties of his were with me so vividly that I could still hear the music and the laughter, faint and incessant from his garden, and the cars going up and down his drive. One night I did hear a material car there, and I saw its light stop at his front steps, but I didn't investigate. It was probably some final guest who had been away at the ends of the earth and didn't know that the party was over. On the last night, with my trunk packed and my car sold to the grocer, I went over and looked at the huge incoherent failure of a house once more. On the white steps, an obscene word scrawled by some boy with a piece of brick stood out clearly in the moonlight, and I erased it, drawing my shoe raspingly along the stone. Then I wandered down to the beach and sprawled out on the sand. Most of the big shore places were closed now, and there were hardly any lights except the shadowy, moving glow of a ferry boat across the sound. And as the moon rose higher and the inessential houses began to melt away until gradually I became aware of the old island here that flowered once for the Dutch sailor's eyes, a fresh green breast of the new world. Its vanished trees and trees that had made way for Gatsby's house had once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all the human dreams. For a transitory enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent. Compelled into aesthetic contemplation, he neither understood nor desired. Face to face for the last time in history with something to commiserate the capacity for wonder. And as I sat there brooding in the old, unknown world, I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first picked out the green light at the end of Daisy's dock. He had come a long way to his blue lawn, and his dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it. He didn't know that it was already behind him, somewhere back in the rare, vast obscurity beyond the city, where the dark fields and the Republic rolled on under the night. Gatsby believed in the green light, orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we'll run faster, stretch our arms out further, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. And that's it. That's the book. We did it. I don't know how I feel. I feel like I could cry, but also it's just been a weird couple days. I feel proud and accomplished. I feel validated and happy. I feel really lucky that I got to do this. I feel like I shouldn't apologize or make jokes about this being my favorite book, because it's a really good book. And, I feel really thankful that you guys are here and that you listen to this with me, and I hope you give me some sort of feedback. Tell me what you liked, what you didn't like, what you think of it all. It feels so weird and melancholy. Okay, that's it. As always, good night, angels.